You are listening to Shakespeare Decoded, a podcast series by Shakespeare Dallas. At Shakespeare Dallas, we are asked all the time, is Shakespeare still relevant today? There are countless situations in Shakespeare's plays that could be put into the category of the human condition, something that never changes from century to century or country to country, despite all our differences in knowledge, culture, and emphasis. Shakespeare's characters experience practically every human emotion you can think of, and every human situation. The social issues of Shakespeare's day, which feature in the plays, class division, racism, sexuality, intolerance, the role and status of women, crime, war, death, disease, are still the burning issues in today's dysfunctional global society. Each episode features a different host and a unique set of panelists.
All right, hello and welcome everybody to Shakespeare Decoded, Shakespeare Dallas's brand new podcast. This episode is called The Badge of All Our Tribe, Religiosity and Identity in the Merchant of Venice. I am your host today. My name is Megan Harris, and I'm the Programs and Marketing Associate with Shakespeare Dallas. And I'm very, very excited to be joined here by some excellent, excellent guests. So with me today, I have Bishop Ackerman, who is the Assisting Bishop of the Diocese of Fort Worth. I also have Professor Moss, who is a Associate Professor of English at Southern Methodist University. And last but not least, I have Rabbi Stern here with us with Temple Emmanuel, based in the North Texas area. Thank you all so very much for being here today. Really, really appreciate it. So today, we're basically going to focus on what this title entails, of Religiosity and Identity in the Merchant of Venice. So you guys, I want to ask you, first and foremost, for those uninitiated, if we want to talk a little bit about what The Merchant of Venice is about, could I ask you, Professor Moss, if you wouldn't mind just giving us a quick overview of sort of what is The Merchant of Venice about?
Well, the title is a little misleading because the merchant is not the famous Jewish character Shylock, but instead Antonio, a Christian merchant. And Antonio and Shylock are not friendly. Antonio has oppressed Shylock, really. Shylock is a moneylender in Venice and practices usury, so lending money at interest. And Antonio, as a Christian, thinks that this is sinful and therefore makes Shylock's life very difficult. So at the beginning of The Merchant of Venice, there's a long and involved love plot involving one of Antonio's friends, kind of friendly, pleasant, handsome wastrel named Bassanio. And without getting into that plot too much, because I don't think that really concerns us here, Antonio ends up borrowing money from Shylock in order to help his friend Bassanio. And they make what Shylock calls a merry bond, according to which if Antonio defaults, Shylock gets to take a pound of his flesh in whichever part pleases him best. And so, needless to say, Antonio defaults, and nobody can persuade Shylock not to take the pound of flesh. And at the end of the play, it's only through a lot of machinations that Shylock is prevented from doing this. The comedy is preserved, and at the end, Shylock has to convert. There's also a subplot involving Shylock's daughter, Jessica, who elopes with a Christian and marries him and takes all of Shylock's jewels and money with her, much of it. And so, needless to say, this has become a very controversial play, and most people, like my own father, just consider it Shakespeare's an anti-Semite. Look at The Merchant of Venice.
Yeah, so I guess that segues us right into, I'm curious, and I'd love to hear from all three of you. I'll start with Bishop Ackerman. What was sort of your first engagement with this play? What were your first impressions of it? And then has any of your thoughts on the play changed since maybe when you first heard about it, you know, in high school or whenever you heard about it?
One of my very first books from my godparents was a book about Shakespeare, and The Merchant of Venice happened to be in the middle of it as a type of synopsis. So from an early age, I was struck by it. But in particular, I was struck by it because all of my heroes were in the neighborhood next to me. I was brought up on Jenny Lind Street, which, as you probably figured out, was a Swedish neighborhood. And right next to it was the Jewish neighborhood, where Yiddish was spoken. And I spent a great deal of my time sitting at the feet of my Jewish heroes. So I had to spend some time trying to figure out how all of this squared up. And it really wasn't until later on when I was struck with the question, is this indicating that Shakespeare himself was anti-Semitic, or was he writing about anti-Semitism? And I guess it was at that point that I began asking some deeper and more difficult questions.
Rabbi Stern, I'd love to hear your sort of engagement as well.
I think I probably first encountered the play in high school English class, which is where I first fell in love with Shakespeare in a love that has endured. Unfortunately, as we do most high school teaching of Shakespeare, it was with a printed page and not with a performance, treating Shakespeare as text rather than as event. So it wasn't as vivid. My sensibility wasn't as vivid until I first saw performances. And I think Shylock is a huge problem for Shakespeare dramaturgically, as Professor Moss could probably explain to us better than I could, but also this portrayal of a figure who is in many ways these days portrayed sympathetically, which means that the anti-Semitic portrayal particularly stings, right? If the character is portrayed comically, then its anti-Semitism doesn't sting as much. But I think since in performance history, probably since the 18th century, certainly by the 19th, the character is largely portrayed with some element of pathos, which means that the anti-Semitic tone of much of how he's portrayed hurts.
So I think that kind of launches us right into sort of the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is looking at this from a historical point of view, right? I mean, we have The Merchant of Venice is set, as we know, in 16th century Venice. And Venice, we've had some preliminary discussions before we met here today. And one of the things I would love for you guys to touch on again is sort of what Venice meant to an Elizabethan audience and what that cosmopolitan culture was understood to be and maybe what it was in practicality. But I would love to talk about briefly the Jewish sort of diaspora in Europe at this time and sort of explaining how Shakespeare and how an Elizabethan audience would have understood the relationship of Jews and Christians within Venice itself. So I guess, Professor Moss, if we could start with you, what sort of was the dynamic between Jews and Christians in 16th century Venice at this time?
The Jews in Venice were consigned to a ghetto, the Ghetto Vecchio, which is a part of Venice you can still visit today. It's a beautiful part of Venice. But, you know, it became a kind of paradigmatic city of a Christian city with a kind of bubble of Judaism inside it that was sort of separated, sequestered from the rest. And as far as the English were concerned, Venice was a fascinating melting pot, cosmopolitan city with all kinds of mixture of Jews and Christians, but also a mixture of the West and the East, the North and the South. It seemed to be at the center of the world. And as a maritime empire, which was also a republic, it was just this kind of crazy curiosity that Englishmen wanted to visit. And there are actually sort of travel diaries of English travelers in Venice, including a very famous one called Coriate's Crudities by a guy named Thomas Coriate. And when the English went to Venice, going to the ghetto was one of the stops on the itinerary. And Thomas Coriate actually went to the Venetian ghetto, tried to convert the Jews there, and was sort of asked in no mistakable terms to leave. But I think that sort of sense of fascination. You would go, you would visit the courtesans, who were also famous in Venice, and the Jews. You would go see the Jews, and then you would try to go to a service, a Shabbat service or something like that, or to a circumcision. And there are all of these sort of reports back about what circumcisions are like. This kind of fascinated horror at this practice that just didn't happen very much at all in England.
Well, yeah, I think that gives us a great context. And you had touched on this, and I'd love for you to expand on it further. So obviously, we're talking about Venice, but of course, Shakespeare is operating in Elizabethan England, which is very far away, nor had he ever traveled to Venice, right? So there's sort of this English understanding of what Venice is, and I'd be curious to hear sort of you to expand on that a little more. What was Shakespeare dealing with as far as, what was his understanding of Judaism? What was his understanding of what he was writing about at the time?
His understanding of Judaism, I think he's fascinated, but also pretty ignorant by and large. I think that for Shakespeare, he's working in a tradition of stage Jews. Shylock is not the first, and he's not the last, of this stereotypical character on the Elizabethan stage. And you might think of Merchant of Venice, for instance, as a companion play to that other Venice, Venetian play that Shakespeare wrote, Othello, the subtitle of which is The Moor of Venice. So Venice is kind of the go-to spot for the exotic, the different, and this is Shakespeare's installment in the tradition of the Jewish character. Now, compared to the other Jewish characters that we have in extant texts from the Elizabethan period, Shylock is a relatively nice guy. And this is one of the arguments you'll find for Merchant of Venice actually as being a philo-Semitic play. This is what I answered back when my dad asked me, don't I think this is an anti-Semitic play? I said, well, not compared to Barabbas in The Jew of Malta by Christopher Marlowe as the other most famous Jewish character. And he's a fascinating figure. He, The Jew of Malta, he's very stereotypical. I have a little bit of his speech. So in the middle of The Jew of Malta, Barabbas buys an African slave named Itamar, and he's a Muslim, and they compare notes on how much damage they've done to Christian communities in their time, and they boast about it. And so what I'm about to read is ugly, but I didn't write it. Barabbas says, "As for myself, I walk abroad o' nights and kill sick people groaning under walls. Sometimes I go about and poison wells, and now and then to cherish Christian thieves, I am content to lose some of my crowns, that's money, that I may, walking in my gallery, see him go pinioned along by my door. Being young, I studied physic, that's medicine, and began to practice first upon the Italian. There I enriched the priests with burials, and always kept the sexton's arms in ure with digging graves and ringing dead men's knells. And after that I was an engineer, and in the wars twixt France and Germany, under pretense of helping Charles V, slew friend and enemy with my stratagems. And after that I was a usurer," and so on. So you can see this catalog of supposedly Jewish crimes and treachery that's spouted by Marlowe's Barabbas. And relative to him, Shylock is something like, not a saint, but a human being. And I think that's the way you can find value in The Merchant of Venice and not simply decide ahead of time that it's anti-Semitic.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing we seem to find with Shakespeare often is that it's often more of a gray area than what's on face value. You know, that's one of the beautiful things about Shakespeare is that he's always creating real humans, complicated as they are, you know. Thank you so much for sharing that. That was really excellent. I think what we're going to do now is we're going to listen to the first voiceover section that we have, and I'd love to hear thoughts after we listen to it. But this first section comes from Act 1, Scene 3 of The Merchant of Venice. And we're going to take a listen, and then we will chat about it afterwards.
How like a fawning publican he looks. I hate him, for he is a Christian. But more for that in low simplicity, he lends out money gratis and brings down the rate of usance here with us in Venice. If I can catch him once upon the hip, I will feed fat the ancient grudge I bear him. He hates our sacred nation, and he rails even there where merchants most do congregate on me, my bargains, and my well-won thrift, which he calls interest. Cursed be my tribe, if I forgive him. I am debating of my present store, and by the near guess of my memory, I cannot instantly raise up the gross of full 3,000 ducats. What of that? Tubal, a wealthy Hebrew of my tribe, will furnish me. Besoft, how many months do you desire? Rest you, fair good senor. Your worship was the last man in our mouths.
Shylock? Albeit I neither lend nor borrow by taking nor by giving of excess, yet to supply the ripe wants of my friend, I'll break a custom.
Aye, 3,000 ducats.
And for 3 months.
I had forgot, 3 months. You told me so. Well then, your bond. And let me see. But hear you, methoughts you said you neither lend nor borrow upon advantage.
I do never use it.
When Jacob grazed his uncle Laban's sheep, this Jacob from our holy Abram was, as his wise mother wrought in his behalf, the third possessor. Aye, he was the third.
And what of him? Did he take interest?
No, not take interest, not, as you would say, directly interest. Mark what Jacob did. When Laban and himself were compromised, that all the eanlings which were streaked and pied should fall as Jacob's hire, the ewes being rank, in the end of autumn, turned to the rams, and when the work of generation was, between these woolly breeders in the act, the skillful shepherd peeled me certain wands, and in the doing of the deed of kind, he stuck them up before the fulsome ewes, who then conceiving did in eaning time fall party-colored lambs, and those were Jacob's. This was a way to thrive, and he was blessed, and thrift is blessing if men steal it not.
This was a venture, sir, that Jacob served for, a thing not in his power to bring to pass, but swayed and fashioned by the hand of heaven. Was this inserted to make interest good, or is your gold and silver ewes and rams?
I cannot tell. I make it breed as fast. But note me, senor.
Mark you this, Bassanio, the devil can cite scripture for his purpose. An evil soul producing holy witness is like a villain with a smiling cheek, a goodly apple rotten at the heart. Oh, what a goodly outside falsehood hath.
Rabbi Stern, I'd like to start with you. I've got a couple of questions, but first I'd just like to sort of hear your thoughts and response to that, and then we'll move from there.
It's not Shylock's strongest argument. The episode of Jacob in Genesis and his prophet making, which is legit but sort of strangely supernatural or Mendelian or something. It's not quite clear which one it is. But yeah, it's not his strongest argument because it's really not evidence of lending it interest. So it's he's citing the wrong scripture. But I think that what it clearly introduces is the question of usury and the distinction in perception of usury in different religious traditions. The Bible, of course, in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy prohibit lending at interest. The English word usury has come to take on, Professor Moss, not surprisingly, defined it correctly. Usury simply means lending at interest, right? It's taken on connotations of excess, although that's not its original definition. So when we use the adjective usurious, we're implying excessive, almost punitive levels of interest, when in fact it just means lending at interest. The reason that usury was prohibited initially was because it was always in the context of a poor person asking for a loan. So usury was seen as exploiting the poverty of another person and is in the catalog of biblical commandments that talk about the compassion with which we should treat the poor. Over time, and in the Deuteronomy quotation, Deuteronomy makes a distinction between lending an interest to members of the people of Israel and lending an interest to people outside the community of Israel. And it's Deuteronomy actually permits lending an interest to folks outside the community of Israel. So that's sort of the biblical foundation. Ezekiel rails against it, and it gains more traction in rabbinic literature. But the issue here is, and I think this goes back to some of what Professor Moss was discussing, is a lot of the medieval prohibitions against Jewish landowning, against Jewish participation in certain businesses, against Christians hiring a Jewish doctor. A lot of those prohibitions get kind of flexible once a need arises. So there are popes who said you can't hire a Jewish doctor until they got sick, at which point all of a sudden, lo and behold, they managed to engage a Jewish doctor, right? There is a sort of looking down the nose at lending at interest until you start to develop the kind of commercial culture that Professor Moss discussed. And in that commercial culture, we're no longer talking about abusing the poor. We're talking about a calculation of risk, right? If I loan you money, what protection do I have if you can't pay me, right? So it starts to enter a whole different framework than the framework of charity to the poor. You have merchants exactly like Antonio who need Jewish moneylenders, and you get that classic medieval trope of Jews being forced into a very limited number of occupations for which they were then condemned for being engaged in. Right? So we're not going to let you own land. We're only going to let you do commerce. So now we're going to call you shadowy cosmopolitan threats with an international web of connection. It actually feeds directly into contemporary anti-Semitism. So the idea that Shylock is then forced into a particular kind of position that he's then condemned for is a very familiar trope of medieval and contemporary anti-Semitism.
So it seems to me, and I would love for you guys to chime in, but it seems that there's this socio-political sort of role that economics are playing here and sort of how a Christian community gets around the ability to moneylend by outsourcing it to another marginalized community, right? But obviously, we're not just talking about economics here. I know it's The Merchant of Venice, and economics obviously play a huge role in this play, interestingly enough. But we're also talking about social dynamics and identity and culture, right? That's the other kind of main point at which Antonio and Shylock are sort of foils of each other, right? They're in opposite corners of the ring, both economically and then also identity-wise and socially, culturally. So that's one of the other things that I would love to tackle with you all. I think what we'll do first is we'll listen to the next voiceover section, which is really just a continuation of the scene we just listened to. It's another section of that scene. But this will focus a little bit more on identity and how identity is sort of shaped by this scene, by these characters, by Shakespeare in general.
Well, Shylock, shall we be beholding to you?
Signor Antonio, many a time and oft in the Rialto you have rated me about my monies and my usances. Still have I borne it with a patient shrug, for sufferance is the badge of all our tribe. You call me misbeliever, cutthroat dog, and spet upon my Jewish gabardine, and all for use of that which is mine own. Well, then, it now appears you need my help. Go to, then. You come to me and you say, Shylock, we would have monies. You say so, you, that did void your room upon my beard and foot me as you spurn a stranger cur over your threshold. Money's your suit. What should I say to you? Should I not say, hath a dog money? Is it possible a cur can lend 3,000 ducats? Or shall I bend low and in a bondman's key with bated breath and whispering humbleness say this? Fair sir, you spat on me on Wednesday last. You spurned me such a day. Another time you called me dog. And for these courtesies I'll lend you thus much monies?
I am as like to call thee so again, to spat on thee again, to spurn thee too. If thou wilt lend this money, lend it not as to thy friends, for when did friendship take a breed for barren metal of his friend? But lend it rather to thine enemy, who, if he break, thou mayst with better face exact the penalty.
Why, look you, how you storm. I would be friends with you and have your love. Forget the shames that you have stained me with. Supply your present wants and take no doit of usance for my monies, and you'll not hear me. This is kind I offer.
This were kindness.
This kindness will I show. Go with me to a notary. Seal me there your single bond, and in a merry sport, if you repay me not on such a day, in such a place, such sum or sums as are expressed in the condition, let the forfeit be nominated for an equal pound of your fair flesh, to be cut off, taken, in what part of your body pleaseth me.
Content in faith. I'll seal to such a bond, and say there is much kindness in the Jew.
Oh, Father Abram, what these Christians are, whose own hard dealings teaches them suspect the thoughts of others. Pray you, tell me this. If he should break his day, what should I gain by the exaction of the forfeiture? A pound of man's flesh taken from a man is not so estimable, profitable neither, as flesh of muttons, beefs, or goats. I say, to buy his favor, I extend this friendship. If he will take it, so. If not, adieu. And for my love, I pray you wrong me not.
Yes, Shylock, I will seal unto this bond.
Then meet me forthwith at the notary's. Give him direction for this merry bond. And I will go and purse the ducat straight, see to my house left in the fearful guard of an unthrifty knave, and presently I will be with you.
Hi thee, gentle Jew.
Oh, and one of the things I think we should define, ducats were the currency of Venice at the time. Great. So here in this section, I think you all are probably going to nod your heads and agree with me, you know, that we're sort of dealing more with an identity situation here, how Shylock and Antonio define themselves and how they define themselves in the relationship to one another, what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be a Jew culturally. But I'd love to start with Professor Moss. I guess one of the basic questions, the dramaturgical questions of this scene I would love for you to break down is how dramaturgically is Shakespeare sort of creating conflict through identity in this scene? What ways is he sort of showing us the difference, I guess, between Shylock and Antonio?
Well, I think he's being very, very clever because, you know, in another one of those stage Jew plays, really the worst of them, I think, one called A Christian Turned Turk by a guy named Robert Dayborn a little while after The Merchant of Venice, 1612 or something like that. There's another villainous Jewish character named Ben Wash. And Ben Wash is just villainous through and through, and he's evil compared to all of the Christian characters on stage and even all of the Muslim characters on stage. He sells a father's children into slavery in front of the father's eyes, and the father dies. He strangles his own adulterous wife. He's just villainous. And I think that could be a kind of obvious stage Jew in an obvious relationship to the other characters of that play. But the scene we just heard, it seems to be, scrambles identities for an audience that's used to those kinds of stage Jews. It's a really strange Jew we have on the stage here, because after all, he's not super rich, as far as I could tell, since he's going to have to borrow money from his friend Tubal, who is a stereotypical stage Jew, in order to be able to loan Antonio the money. He isn't lending an interest, right? Not technically. He's going to take a pound of flesh, which is a bit of a problem. But in any case, if we expect the Jew to be greedy, he points out, I can't really use the pound of flesh for anything. Meanwhile, if we look at Antonio, this wonderful sort of exemplar of Christian charity who lends his money so freely to his friend Bassanio that he's actually out of money, he likes to spit on people. He likes to spit on Shylock's gabardine, that's his cloak, and then for good measure, he's going to spit on his beard to void your room upon my beard, says Shylock. And what does Shylock do? He quite specifically turns the other cheek, right? Which is supposed to be what the Christian is supposed to be doing. And by now we're probably asking, well, wait a second, is Antonio a good Christian? And we might think back to that first scene you played where he talks about the apple, the Jew is like the apple that's goodly on the outside and rotten at the core. And I think what's happening is we thought this was going to be a play about Jewish crimes and villainies, just another Benwash kind of play. And instead, it seems to be about Christian hypocrisy. And, you know, by the end of this play, there's going to be a big trial. And Shylock's going to be on trial. Well, I'm sorry, Antonio. There's a big trial, but, you know, it's Venice, really, that is on trial at the end of that play, Christian Venice. And I don't know that it passes the test.
Can I jump in on the trial? I love what Professor Moss just said about the mixing of identity. And there's a line in the trial that I think is supposed to be played as a laugh line, like dramatic irony, when Portia walks in as Balthazar. And she says, which is the merchant here and which is the Jew? And I've decided that's the most important line in the play, because I think that is exactly what Professor Moss just described. I think that's Shakespeare's goal, is to leave us scratching our heads and saying, which is the merchant here and which is the Jew? That is, which is, where is greed located? Not that Jew should equal greed, obviously, but in the stereotypes, where is greed located here? Where is hypocrisy located here? Where is cruelty located here? Where is mercy located here? And I think Professor Moss is exactly right. Shakespeare sort of puts it all in a blender and asks us to be dislocated, which again could be a move of empathy with Jews. I don't think it was conscious, right? But we are asked, the play dislocates us. And in that way, makes us all Jews.
I am so intrigued by that because, as I indicated, the conflict that I had in my earlier readings as to whether it was anti-Semitic or about anti-Semitism, for me, was answered with this very point that both of you have made so remarkably. And that's because Shakespeare is no stranger to Christian hypocrisy, was he? Because this, for example, was the prayer book that would have been required. This is the 1559 Book of Common Prayer. And if one looks very carefully at it, in the Elizabethan settlement, here's an attempt to be able to take several groups of people who are diametrically opposed to one another, to get Puritans who are saying, not too much still left of Rome, Anglicans saying, I think we're getting to a better point, and then in the background, those who are still secretly Roman Catholic. Because to be a Roman Catholic at that time would be to have done it secretly, which leads us to perhaps one of Shakespeare's possible digs, because there is a very good indication that Shakespeare's father remained a Roman Catholic, although in secret. And I know there's a great deal of debate over that, so I'm not going to press it, except to say that there are those who say that, to quote one author, he said, and we all know that Shakespeare died as a papist. Well, I don't know that for a fact, but certainly it raises some questions that Shakespeare himself was in the crossfire of Christians who couldn't really ultimately agree on what exactly it means to be a Christian. Now, afterwards, there was some attempt to be able to say, well, at least let's have a word we can agree upon. And all one has to do is look at the intrigue of the coming together, the authorized version, aka the King James Version of the Bible, and go back in a particular book called God's Secretaries, and to look in the background of how there are arguing with each other over translations. Out of that, whispering came about of the various kind of hypocrisy that was going on, forcing a book on us that we can't all agree upon. Well, I wonder if Shakespeare wasn't really saying, and here's a 1700 version by the way, a 1711 version of the King James Bible. If Shakespeare wasn't saying, okay, Christians, you've spent so much time talking about these Jewish people, would you like to have a mirror put up in front of you and let's talk about hypocrisy, where you say one thing and you really are functioning in a very different way?
Yeah, that's really interesting that you bring that up, because yeah, it seems that certainly at the end of the play, spoilers, Shylock unfortunately does not get his way, does not win the trial like he was hoping he would. Not only is he, you know, obviously forced to give up his bond, he's also forced to give up much of his property and earnings to the state, as well as being forced to convert. And this is, of course, something that contextually over the course of history is the context of that changes, like we said. But believe Rabbi Stern, you shared with us, you know, pre-18th century, Shylock is portrayed as a, you know, as a comic sort of buffoon. So clearly the conversion of him would be, you know, celebrated as a positive thing, right? Increasingly, as we get more into the modern period, the, you know, more sympathetic portrayal of Shylock, that sort of becomes this devastating knell, if you will. It's interesting. I had the opportunity to watch at the Globe in 2015, Jonathan Pryce playing Shylock. And this is available on their website. You can actually purchase it to rent or to buy. So it's all videoed as well. But it's really interesting because they sort of added this pantomime, if you will, or this dialogue-less scene at the end of the play where we actually watch Shylock's conversion. And it's this very, very disturbing and heart-wrenching scene, and he's just crying, and you know, because everything is, his identity has been robbed from him, right? I mean, everything that he defines him as who he is, and it's really interesting. They have Jessica standing by and watching this happen, you know, because she converts as well, right? But it's under a completely different context for a completely different reason, right? And so she's sort of forced to watch, and you kind of have to sit and wonder if she regrets what she's done and her choices. But anyway, but that's just an interesting approach too.
For me, at least, it allows us to see the man. And I think that when we do a type of stereotyping, it is our preconceived notion and our prejudice that paints the person or creates the person. And now all of a sudden, everybody has to come to grips with something. We've all lost somebody. We've all lost everything. And at least for the English people at that time, some of them had to think about a few generations before, where because they were not on the right side of the vote when it came to the Christian vote, if you will, they lost. And so suddenly we're drawn into, I believe, a man who stands before us in a state of vulnerability. And I think once we become vulnerable ourselves, while we identify with those who have suffered loss, we can get underneath the various strata of prejudice that we have created or allowed others to create for us.
First of all, to this idea, I really resonate with Professor Moss's idea that Venice is in some ways an allegory for London, cosmopolitan port cities. And I do think, as Professor Moss mentioned at the beginning, I'm intrigued by the connection between the Merchant of Venice and the Moor of Venice, this notion of the explicitly other in the place that supposedly welcomes everyone and everything, finding that there are limits to the sense of tolerance and toleration. So I think that's really important. The other thing I think is important is that this is happening in the genre context of Shakespearean comedy, which means in that genre, we're used to identity flipping all the time, right? We get it with Nerissa and Portia, right? They're women, they're male lawyers, they're back to women, right? We get the whole thing with the caskets. Like, you don't judge a casket by its cover. It's actually going to be the lead one and not the gold one. Like, there's all this stuff about the untrustworthiness of surface identity, right? Which is common comedic trope for Shakespeare. But what's fascinating is, to go to the bishop's point about stereotype, what stereotype does is it locks in identity in a way that doesn't allow for the humanity or the growth of the person being stereotyped. So again, for me, when Portia says, "Tarry, Jew," right? Like, that is just that is a shackle, right? That is something that is just, that is all that Shylock is. That's not his nickname here, right? That is his totalitarianizing descriptor, right? And when she says that, she is in fact disallowing him everything that makes Venice, Venice, right? You come, you go, you're cosmopolitan, you're here, you're there, you're in the port, you're not in the port, you're on the land, you're on the sea, right? Nerissa can be a guy, then Nerissa can be back to being Nerissa, right? Like, all those things are denied him. And I think that is the denial of humanity that Bishop Ackerman is describing. And then, of course, by the way, your point, he's not allowed to be anything other than how he's branded. And then his fundamental identity is removed from him by the very people who are branding him.
You know, it makes me wonder, how completely Shakespeare wants Shylock to transcend the identity of Terry Jew. I don't know. You know, I've argued a lot so far, I guess, for the play as almost philo-Semitic, but I think it's, like Megan said, Shakespeare lives in a gray area, or he's ambiguous, right? And in Shylock's case, I'm always drawn to this line when Shylock is talking to Tubal after his daughter Jessica has eloped with one of the Christians, and Tubal is kind of tormenting Shylock with the news. He's kind of alternating between tormenting Shylock with the news of all of the wasting, because Jessica took his money and his jewels with her, and she's just being absolutely so profligate. And so Tubal torments Shylock with that news and then teases him with the news that Antonio has lost another ship. And so he goes back and forth. Anyway, Tubal's a nasty little character. And Tubal tells Shylock that he heard that Jessica had given away a ring for a monkey. And Shylock says, "That was my turquoise. Leah gave it to me when I was a bachelor." And he must be referring to his deceased wife. And he says, "I would not have given it for a wilderness of monkeys." And that line, you know, first of all, none of the Christians in the play are able to keep their rings, right? They keep giving them away to anybody. And Shylock knows how to value a ring. But he's having trouble because a wilderness, it's simultaneously where you find the greatest number of monkeys. So it's like the maximal value of monkeys that Shylock could imagine. But it's also a wilderness, and it's worth nothing. And I can't tell whether, you know, it's worth nothing relative to the ring. And so I can't tell whether Shylock is kind of pricing the ring, whether his mind automatically goes to what is most valuable, or whether he understands that the sentiment behind the ring is infinitely more valuable than any number of monkeys. I don't know if I've put that exactly right, but I just think that's that moment strikes me as a moment where Shakespeare refuses to decide whether Shylock transcends the categories others would put him in or not.
Well, I think, and isn't it the same scene where he says he'd rather see Jessica dead in front of him with the jewels in her ear? I mean, there are parts of Shylock that are completely horrific, right? I mean, the ducat's my daughter, the ducat's my daughter. I think you're exactly right. There is, this role is a loaded gun. And the reason to like gulp when someone says they're going to watch or read Merchant of Venice is because you're not sure how that gun is going to be used, right? But it can certainly, it has all the potential in the world to be used to anti-Semitic ends. I totally agree that I think that Shakespeare wants us to be more complicated than that, but there's an opportunity not to be complicated here, and that's where the gulp comes in.
Just to bring it back, the "what I wish she were dead" and the jewels in her ear about his daughter who's eloped with a Christian, there's no forgiving it. It's a horrendous line. But to put it in the context of the stage Jew in Elizabethan England, back to Marlowe's Barabbas, his daughter becomes a nun and goes to a nunnery. And then Barabbas gives a pot of soup to the nuns, poisons the whole nunnery, including his own daughter. So there's a way in which Shylock is just fantasizing he could be as evil as Barabbas sort of demonstrably is the previous stage two.
He's just a Barabbas wannabe.
He's just a Barabbas wannabe.
I think this sort of leads us right into sort of the last voiceover section that I think would be useful. But certainly one of the things that it seems like you guys have teased out is obviously that Shakespeare is wrestling with a lot of different things here, and he's not coming to an absolute clear conclusion. I agree with you, Rabbi Stern, that certainly it could be played. You could ignore some of the glimmers of hope there and play it more straight, and it could absolutely be a very hateful portrayal. But I do think that we're sussing out some things that are far more nuanced than that. And certainly what I think that what this discussion is coming to a head to, and I think what we're all sort of implying, and this is where I would like to now fully jump in the waters here, is sort of what all of this conversation has to do with empathy and what this play and what Shakespeare can teach us about, you know, yes, there's dissidence, yes, there's difference, but ultimately, how are these people all human and how are they all level on the same playing field in the sense that they're all full of hypocrisy, they're all full of good and evil, and what does that say about us and ourselves and putting ourselves into categories and how maybe useless that can be? And certainly, I think it's an important lesson that we gloss over throughout all periods of history, but, you know, we could argue now, you know, we're struggling with that as a culture, even in this moment. So I would love to sort of go into more detail about that after we listen to this last voiceover section, which sort of is what, in what both, well, what everybody has been talking about, sort of this, often what people point to as the sort of case for this play being about anti-Semitism and not being itself anti-Semitic, of course, is the Half-Mounted Jew Eyes speech. So that's what we're going to listen to now, and then let's spend the rest of our time talking about it.
To bait fish withal, if it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated my enemies. And what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions? Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? Why, revenge. The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction.
So I guess the first question I want to pose to you all, and then I will let you expound upon it as you will, why do you think this particular speech has been so impactful for approximately 400 years? What is it about what Shylock is saying here that means anything to us?
Well, for me, the speech is, it's a famous speech, it's a beautiful speech. It's the kind of speech that I've been thinking about my entire life with Shakespeare, because one moment you'll look at it and you'll think it's full of empathy, and another moment you'll look at it and you'll think, I'm being had, this is cruel also. And the structure of the speech is interesting. It's an envelope structure, right, where we start and finish with revenge. And so you have to go into that middle of the speech to find all the humanity. And it's beautifully put, hath not a Jew eyes, hath not a Jew hands, but we're sort of fighting off our back foot a little bit to prove that the Jew is human at all. And even when we prove it, he's so passive, right? Everything is happening to him. He's hurt and subject and healed and warmed and cooled. And if you prick him, he bleeds. And if you tickle him, he laughs. So you kind of get this lack of agency, which these days troubles me. And I've gone through loving this speech and hating it. But in the last few years, I felt that maybe it's not as helpful as I wish it had been.
Within the context of the play, it's Shylock's justification for revenge, right? That's the punchline, right? It is correctly an envelope structure, but the punchline is still, and therefore, because I'm like you, I can do this. And in some ways, in that way, it encapsulates the whole Shylock problem. If he's too sympathetic, the play doesn't work as a comedy, because then Portia's triumph doesn't work, right? If he's too much of a buffoon, then Portia's triumph feels like a cheap shot. So he's got to be placed somewhere in the middle. And I do think it's deeply moving, and then it's undercut, which is why it's Shakespeare. And I love that insight about the passivity of the character. Part of what happens here that I think, again, I do not run the other way when I see that The Merchant of Venice is being performed. I go to see it for exactly the reason, Megan, you're suggesting, because I think it's training in and asks us to reflect upon how we interact with whoever is the other in our lives, right? Like, I think for that reason, I think it is of eternal value. That doesn't obviate the fact that it's troubling in any number of ways. So I think that this passage, the real question is, why should a Jew even have to give that speech, right? I mean, can you imagine hath not a Christian eyes, right? So the very notion that he has to give the speech, then we say, oh, how moving the speech is, but what's the underpinning that allows us to even hear it, like that thinks that it's not even totally absurd for a human being have to wave his arms and say, hey, I'm a human being, right? And similarly, and I totally agree with everything we're saying about that Shakespeare takes the sort of takes Barabbas and in, I think in some ways, some scholars would say in response to Barabbas, right, creates this much more humane, complicated character. I agree with all that, but there's some level at which horribly we resonate to the stereotype. Like we're not surprised by the Jewish moneylender, right? And so the most uncomfortable thing about this speech is why should any human being ever have to give it?
One of the most tragic things, of course, as we fast forward, and I know we're attempting to look at this as to when it was written, by whom it was written, what the circumstances were, is to fast forward and discover that not too long thereafter, century-wise, that would become very popular in Germany. There would be people who'd want to see it, but they'd want to see it because of the stereotype, not because of the personhood, but because of what they considered to be what a real Jew was. And once again, it shows us that even when we're drawn into the most vulnerable of an individual, it doesn't prevent us from succumbing to the population, to the masses, to compromise everything that we believe about humanity for the sake of expediency, for power, and for ultimate payoff. And in that regard, it begs the question from my perspective, in the world in which we live, all these years of recorded history, wasn't there always some kind of historical usury? Not so much that I lent you something and I charged you, but that's what we do with human beings in the end, so often using them for our very own ends and for our own base desires. And as we look at groups throughout the course of history, we conclude that, yes, resoundingly, yes. But Shakespeare invites us into yet another opportunity in my mind to be able to say, yes, 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 indeed. But is there something we can do about it?
One question I always have with Merchant of Venice, if I could add one, is how to teach it. And I wonder actually, Megan, if you've thought, is there a responsibility to perform it one way or the other if it's so ambiguous? You know, I've taught it different ways. Lately, I've been teaching it more about Portia than about Shylock, which might be a kind of avoidance. But given Rabbi Stern, Bishop Ackerman's take on this speech, it almost feels like you have to get it right if you're teaching it or performing it. I'm just wondering, once I go back to teaching Shylock rather than just talking about Portia and her bastard husband, what am I going to, what do you guys think we ought to do, us teachers and performers? And for you, what if you were going to have Merchant of Venice in a sermon? Where does he belong?
I think that I love the idea that you're focusing on Portia. I do think that the fundamental, look, humanity also means that there's gross parts in all of us, right? But I think it's confusing. I think that there is real sort of classic anti-Semitic clickbait here, which means it can be misused. But I also do think that Shakespeare is out to humanize the character. It's again interesting to me that in cosmopolitan Venice, or at least projected cosmopolitan Venice, I keep getting the sense of the isolation of these characters. Like they should be bumping into each other like atoms. And I feel like I always wonder about this, what news? Like it's almost like everybody's ignorant. Everyone's always having to ask, what news on the Rialto? What news on the seas? What news of Belmont? Like there's always this sort of what news question, which to me smacks of a sense of disconnection. And where that's reinforced for me, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this, Professor Moss, is in the classic comedic sort of triple wedding at the end. There's two people who are alone in the end, Shylock and Antonio. Like they're not matched up, unless they're matched up, but they're not matched up. And that again bespeaks to me a certain kind of loneliness of each of these characters. And we could blame Shylock's on Shylock and say how, you know, he burns every Brit, whatever. But it's fascinating that, and again, that's not unusual in the comedies, right? There's always sort of Malvolio hanging out on the other side of the stage kind of thing. So it's always undercut a little bit, but it feels fascinating to me that it's undercut here by the foils, by Antonio and by Shylock.
Well, the same production that Megan referred to before also includes a scene where it's quite obvious that Antonio is in love with Bassanio.
Right.
And
yeah. It's pretty obvious.
And they make it almost explicit. They show him kind of bursting into tears as Bassanio walks off with Portia. You know, I agree with you that there's this disconnect. And it's a play that begins with a comedy that begins with the line, Antonio, I know not wherefore I am so sad.
Mm-hmm.
And
that sort of sadness and solitude is what, you know, Shylock ends up with. But yeah, I think the losers of comedy, the Malvolios who don't get to join in the festivity, here it's more fraught because of the identity crises throughout the play.
Yeah, and I think you bring up this interesting point about what to do with this play and how do we treat it responsibly and with the utmost respect for the other. And I think that that's a question that we all struggle with the canon of Shakespeare. I mean, one of the great examples that you brought up, Professor Moss, is Othello. That's another one that it's like, how do we do this and how do we do it appropriately? Same thing with The Taming of the Shrew. The Taming of the Shrew is yet another one where it's like, how do you reconcile this? How is this a comedy? How does this happy in the end? I mean, what on earth do you do? And I mean, just to share my own personal perspective, I certainly don't speak on behalf of anyone other than myself, but I think that's what, to me, what indicates that it's far more important to keep doing it. Because to shy away from it and to say, oh, that's a problem play and we can't talk about that, we can't discuss that, I frankly think means to erase that complicated moment in history for that particular situation. And I think in order, you know, it's that whole thing that they say that, you know, those who do not learn from their history are bound to repeat it. And so I think that's one of the things that draws me personally as an artist to Shakespeare, is that he deals with these problems and he asks these questions that we still are dealing with today, that are still major socio-political problems today. Take any play, you know, and that's why we keep doing it. And so I think it's an incredible challenge, but I think it's a challenge that we need to rise to in order to honor the past and to continue to move forward in a more positive way. You know what I mean? That's what draws me to this kind of stuff, why I want to have discussions about these kinds of things that do sort of twist people's stomach. I know that, you know, the kind of like, oh, somebody's doing Merchant of Venice. Okay. You know, but I think that's why we have to keep talking about it, to keep it alive and to keep the discussions going so that we're sure that we're not falling into these stereotypes again.
It's interesting that during the Elizabethan settlement in England, that a phrase that was repeated often is that she did not want to produce a window into everyone's soul. She put it differently, real Elizabethan English. But what Shakespeare does is it allows us to look into the very essence of the person. And I think that that's what's so extraordinarily important about presenting something that has not been changed. And that it means we have not brought it up to somehow accommodate the people, but we've asked people to enter into the mystery of that which has been presented so that we can discover it ourselves for the first time as if we were the first to discover it. And upon discovering it, then have to ask the deeper questions of ourselves. Why did I respond that way to this character?
You know, Megan, listening to Bishop Ackerman there and to you, I'm still confused by how to perform or teach this play. It seems to me that the Globe production you refer to, by having Shylock essentially crucified after the play, a sort of epilogue, tells us how to view it safely.
Mm-hmm.
And it closes down the problem that Rabbi Stern raised earlier before, that the play is a loaded gun, and in the wrong hands, it could go off in the... And I think, so there's a risk to performing it straight, if there is such a thing, and not adding some kind of paratextual, I'm going to go ahead and write this scene, I'm going to script a stage direction for the actor playing Antonio to do something that, you know, the audience will understand as a signal for how to think about him and how to think about this play, and instead to let the audience live with the ambiguity, when the ambiguity, which is there in every Shakespeare play, is going to be about it's going to be about hate, then it's going to be all the more pressure on the teacher or the pastor or the performer to try to control the way the audience responds to it. But I don't think that's what Shakespeare was really after. I think Shakespeare wanted his audience to be uncomfortable, uneasy. And there's a good link with Othello there, because Othello puts a black character on stage, and it's a black character that nobody in the audience would ever recognize, a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And Iago makes it his business to make sure that by the end of the play, the black character is very recognizable as a devil. And I think that is designed not to soothe the audience's consciences and make them think they're great for the way they already thought before they entered the theater. It's to make them uncomfortable. And so maybe that's what's going to have to happen in the classroom or the theaters an uncomfortable audience at the end of The Merchant of Venice is the right audience.
It's been said about sermons that they are designed to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And I think oftentimes that's what theater can do, is that our task is not always to comfort people, but it's rather to be able to look at us in our comfort zones and ask us, how far out can you walk?
Megan, I would totally agree with you. I never think we should refrain from producing this play because of all the questions and because I do agree with the notion of discomfort as a worthy goal. I think particularly in our current cultural context, I'm going to go back to something that Professor Moss said earlier. Even if Shakespeare had physically never met a Jew, like even if there weren't the people coming into the port of London and there weren't the new Christians, the Jew was still present in that culture as an idea. And then people made judgments based on the idea. And that seems to me the trap that is before our culture all the time. How many people have notions of Islam who've never met a Muslim, right? How many people have notions of what a Mexican immigrant is who have never met a Mexican immigrant, right? Meeting the person is neither antidote nor poison, right? And having that image in the absence of the person allows the image to be, as Professor Moss has just said, allows the image to be uncomplicated, right? If I never have to meet that person, then my image remains pristine. And I think that is a huge peril in contemporary culture. And I think, either ironically or appropriately enough, in America, which is supposed to be Venice, right? Like in our culture, we're still holding on to unpeopled ideas and then raise all sorts of money and banners around those ideas that have never encountered humanity. And in that way, I think that the whole sort of wonderful stew of ideas that we've been discussing here today is of urgent importance for the world in which we live.
I really appreciate that, Rabbi Stern. I think I couldn't agree with you more. Well, thank you all so very, very much for your time. I so, so appreciate it. Thank you, Bishop Ackerman. Thank you, Professor Moss. Thank you, Rabbi Stern, for your time, for your knowledge. This was such a wonderful conversation, but we really look forward to having you check us out. And thank you again, all three of you, for your time. Looking forward to further conversations in the future.
Thank you for listening to Shakespeare Decoded, presented by Shakespeare Dallas. For more information about Shakespeare Dallas, visit shakespeare-dallas.org.